That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
You want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
For 15 years, I've been trying to teach you how to write a lead. Do I have to do everything myself? Get the story? Write the story?
Listen, saphead, I could blow a better story out of my nose than you can write.
And we got stories coming out our ears today. Knute Berger is here, writes that Crosscut is the Moss Bag. Good to see you again, Skip.
Good to be back, Steve.
I used your nickname, so now that's it. Eli Sanders is here. Good to see you again, Eli.
Nice to see you.
Joni Balter is here. Eli Sanders is assistant editor at The Stranger, I'm sorry. And Joni Balter is a host of the Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Good to see you again.
See ya. Good morning.
So I just wanted to start with and hear from a different voice. As you've been hearing all morning, President Obama accepted the resignation of Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Kaczynski. It came hours after the general apologized, accepted responsibility for the health care scandal. It's turned his agency into a war zone and caused many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle to call for his resignation. It also came on the heels of a scathing Inspector General's report that found systemic problems at VA facilities in Phoenix. The VA has acknowledged 23 deaths nationwide due to delayed care. The VA's acting Inspector General told a Senate committee that in recent weeks his investigation so far had found a possible 17 deaths of veterans waiting for care in Phoenix. Now, Alfie Alvarado Ramos is director of Washington State Department of Veteran Affairs. She was appointed by Governor Inslee. Before that, she was deputy director for many years. The Washington State Department of Veterans Affairs is a state agency. It helps connect veterans and their family members to the benefits and services they earned through their military service. So that agency is charged with working with the federal VA, but also advocating for vets and sometimes prodding the VA into action. I called her up to ask her, first of all, her reaction to Kaczynski resigning, but also the reaction to some of these reports that are looked at veterans' facilities around the country and what we know about Washington State.
Preliminary reviews of facilities in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, which are part of what's called VISN 20, which is a regional medical VA medical network, have not turned up concerns such as those in Phoenix. You know, however, you know, we're staying close to the, to the medical services, to the VISN director, just to make sure and ensure that veterans who need care are assigned that care as quickly as possible, even if it has to be provided outside of the VA.
Now, you are responsible in part for making sure the federal government is providing Washington State veterans the care and service they earned while serving. What is the VA? What's the systemic problem here? What's the underlying problem?
I think it's access, because once somebody is inside of the system and is getting the appointments, you know, the quality of care is second to none. It's really very good quality of care. The problem is that the salaries and the recruitment of qualified physicians is lacking. You know, if you've seen the reports, you know, a physician in any kind of network earns anywhere from $225,000 to $200,000. And $50,000 as a primary physician, and specialists go far beyond that. You know, so the VA has salaries that are much lower, and therefore they have not been able to attract and retain, you know, the quality physicians that they need to provide services. Therefore, they end up with significant gaps, you know, in the specialties that are in, but mostly affect veterans in cardiology, urology, you know, cancer treatment, and on. You know, so therefore, those gaps are very hard to fill. In place of them providing the care, then they have to go outside of the VA to be able to provide that care, which sometimes can be three times more expensive, and the VA has a budget issue.
So what would you say to Patty Murray, the senator who's chair of the Veterans Affairs? Would you say you have to get more money, roll, expand the service?
Exactly, where, you know, first of all, the systemic issues need to be fixed. You know, the expectations, you know, of a certain amount of time to be provided, you know, for primary care appointments and specialty appointments needs to be reviewed, you know, with realistic, you know, expectations when it comes to the capacity of each and every different hospital. Because even though they're part of a system, each hospital is different just because of the region they may be. You know, and Senator Murray very early, even prior to Kaczynski, identified you know, that there were shortfalls in the funding of the VA, and actually was able to, as chair of the committee, be able to place additional funding in the VA to do more regarding, you know, the cost of doing business. So she identified a long time ago, you know, that the VA still was not receiving the amount of funding that they needed. Now Congress, along with Senator Murray, needs to be able to take a look at what is the appropriate funding, you know, of care for those who fought, because we're quick to go into a war, but slow into funding the care of those who fought it.
What's the timeline that you want to see for reforms in Phoenix and around the VA system nationwide?
Well, reforms should start taking place immediately, you know, through revising, you know, the expectations, through being able to, you know, to get feedback from the employees on what is reasonable, you know, through being able to identify the bad operators, you know, who cause, you know, this particular mess, and be able to deal with them appropriately, meaning if they need to go, they need to go, and therefore start placing, you know, in those positions people who have the best interests of veterans at heart, who are going to be able to get the funding that they need to be able to conduct their business.
And just to clarify, Ms. Ramos, when you say deal with expectations, you mean both on the side of the veterans or on the side of the institutions who promise one thing and can't deliver?
On both sides, you know, because, you know, our veterans should be able to expect to get the care that they need, you know, at the appropriate time to ensure that they, you know, will have a quality of life. And then, you know, expectations on the institutions to be able to, you know, once as they get the funding that they need, as they have the leadership that actually sets reasonable metrics for them to be able to perform by, you know, and have those conversations of what truly is needed to be able to operate, that it all works in unison. And as you know, the federal VA is probably one of the largest, if not the largest, healthcare system in this country. You know, so a system that large is going to be difficult to fix.
That's Alvi Alvarado Ramos. She's director of the Washington State Department of Veterans Affairs. Senator Patty Murray is going to be talking about some issues, and I'm sure she will address the question of Shinseki's resignation. We'll hear more about that later on KUOW. So let's turn to what happened with the minimum wage discussion and Shama Sawant. In particular, Shama Sawant declared victory. She said that they had won. And Eli, on the slog, you posted some images.
Well, Anna Menard, who's been covering this for The Stranger very, very closely, posted some images, first of all, of the celebration at City Hall after yesterday's vote. And then, more interestingly, to the question of where 15 Now is going with its proposed ballot measure, images that they sent out afterward in an email saying, "We won." They're declaring victory. And today, Anna has an image up of the 15 Now logo with the NOW flipped, I believe it is, and it's just 15-1. So you can hear them making that victory declaration that other people were trying to goad Sawant into a long time ago. You know, do you remember that Westneat column and other people saying, why can't she just declare victory now? She won. Well, she hadn't considered that she won yet until it was voted on in the city council. And now it looks like they are willing to say they've won. They're not willing to say we won't run this ballot initiative. But it seems hard to imagine that if they're declaring victory today and yesterday, they'll be running a ballot measure in November.
As Anna Menard quotes them in the slog, this is her. So they could still decide to run a charter amendment, which they've always said was a backup plan, a fail-safe mechanism. And they won't say one way or the other, at least so far, whether they're going to pull the charter amendment until the $15 wage bill becomes law and their organization makes a democratic decision on the matter. So they'll vote.
And on the question of when the bill will become law, that could be as early as Wednesday. The council is going to vote in the full council on Monday to make this proposal a law that goes to Ed Murray for his signature. And there's talk of a signing ceremony on Tuesday or Wednesday.
Yeah, but consider here, there's an interesting little tap dance going on here because the city council thinking that there still will be a charter amendment and they don't know how to plan for whatever happens in November has already, as a committee of the council, gone on record and changed the start date of the whole thing, you know, because it has this long rollout. So instead of starting on January 1st, if the full council goes along in its formal vote on Monday, it will start on April 1st, not the best day to pick for any dramatic change, but nonetheless, that they've already sort of finessed the start date to accommodate a charter amendment that is maybe in the dustbin.
And I did not realize.
Kind of wild.
April 1st, I did not realize that.
We should just say quickly that the 15 Now charter amendment is not the only threatened ballot measure out there, but we did hear this week that One Seattle will not, this is the pro-business group, will not be running an amendment in the fall. So that could have been something else that was on the council's mind when they were thinking about this.
So we did see a few tweaks. We saw the movement of the date for when it would start, and we saw a training wage for younger workers, minors. We thought maybe that would be the first of things unraveling, but they've held it together, even though we're starting to hear now from people who were on the committee saying this was a bad deal. I talked to Dave Minert yesterday. That's going to run on the record. The words he used were more than a bad deal. They were a little harsher than that.
Yeah, I read his Facebook post.
Dave Minert's a restaurateur.
Yeah, he's a nightlife and owner and restaurateur. He was a big backer of Mike McGinn. Became disillusioned toward the end of the McGinn administration and backed Murray. He was a business representative on the 15 committee. And you know, and has a devastating critique from his perspective about the process. Feels the committee was just window dressing, that the mayor caved to labor, that the agreement that's been not just passed, but that the mayor proposed was didn't reflect the consensus of some of the members. However, they have said that the chamber and whatnot are not going to run their own initiative. So I think what's going to happen is, and I think it's interesting if the 15 Now people decide not to run their initiative, you basically have people who've all made compromises having to live with that, but that doesn't mean they're not going to bitch about it for a long time. And there are a lot of troublesome implementation details that will provide opportunities for people to nibble away at this thing.
And speaking of nibbling, the business community, one reason maybe that they feel comfortable saying they won't do an initiative is they're the ones that have been shaking the tree at City Hall much of this week with the training wage, with the teen wage. They seem like they're not finished. You know, they're still working it and they still have, well, the whole weekend, I suppose. One nuance that I was not familiar with, which a city council member carefully explained to me this morning, is that if 15 Now, 15-1, I'm not sure what to call it, does proceed, they were proceeding not with just a basic initiative. They were proceeding with a charter amendment. So you think about that. So it would be written. I mean, I knew that, but I didn't really ponder it. They would be proceeding with something that actually writes into the city charter that this is our policy. So a little harder to change.
Back on Minert, while we're getting his angry loser's howl on the record, we should also get more fully what he said. I mean, in addition to talking about the process as a charade full of bad faith negotiating and political blackmail and accusing the mayor, who Dave Minert in his wisdom endorsed, as running a staff that was either incompetent or intentionally dishonest. In addition to all of that, Dave Minert, again, who endorsed the mayor, said he's so upset he'll retire from public life potentially from this. So another thing we can maybe hold him to.
I don't know. I mean, I think it sounded to me like it was a real dip into the sausage-making machine that is common at the legislature. The mayor knows how to do that. I think the 50 Now people, I think they're smart to declare victory. And I think they've proven that what you can do with the sledgehammer of a popular initiative, a simple slogan, and a progressive mayor who's willing to work on the sort of dirty details of actually making it happen.
For what it's worth, I pre-interviewed Nick Hanauer before a civic cocktail that's coming up next week. And he was praising the heck out of the mayor, talking about how, you know, just how amazing it was to forge this compromise between all these disparate interests, and that it was always shaky, but it just to watch this actually happen. And so, you know, obviously sounding more supportive of the whole process. And he, you know, and he's one of the originals on 15 now.
Do you think the training wage, the wage for minors, mollifies business to the point where they don't have to change this amendment much further, but simply work in the rules as it's applied?
Well, the one thing I
those businesses who
the one thing I heard was it was sort of codifying state law in some ways, and that it didn't affect a whole ton of people.
I agree. I don't think the idea that a training wage was inserted into the proposal is quite right. I think that they reflected state law in the measure that passed out of the committee, and the devil will be in the future details. As I understood it, they passed an amendment to create some sort of city director who can make rules about training wages. So that means it remains to be seen. Anna Menard also wrote a good piece for The Stranger. The headline you could search for it was "What's the Deal with Training Wages?" where she explains some of this. But the fear about them is that they will become a big loophole that businesses could use to pay short-term employees less than the minimum wage and just call it a training wage. But in businesses where you have high turnover, does anyone even get out of the training wage? And so the city director will hopefully make rules about that.
I think one of the interesting things about this is it's an experiment. It's never been done before. No city's ever tried something like this. We don't know whether this is going to become the new standard like the 8-hour day or the 40-hour work week or whether it's going to be a complete train wreck. One of the things that people often mistake is that our economy and everything goes progressively onward and upward, and they calculate in these projections on how wages will increase based on cost of living. We could hit another recession. There are a lot of things that could derail this. We don't know what the actual impact will be on business. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it, but I think we need to be realistic about understanding that we're doing something that's never been tried. It's a civic experiment. It's a social experiment. It's a labor experiment. It's a political experiment. And let's hope it's a good thing, but it might not be.
Not a train wreck. We wouldn't want that.
Train wreck for a training wage. Oh yeah. So anyway, one thing about that's really bad, isn't it? Okay. So restaurateur.
They're going to start giving you a training wage after that pun.
So restaurateur Tom Douglas, who many people know, actually implemented his own $15 an hour wage back in August, actually mentioned, I don't know that he used the phrase training wage, but a six-month sort of entry point before you get the $15 an hour. So this idea has been bopping around.
Just on the when the council votes on Monday, they're still going to vote on Monday, on the full council will vote. There is also in that proposal a minimum, I think they're called a wage commission or a minimum wage commission. I don't know if they had quite the title yet, or I don't know it.
Well, there's some office that is being created, and the way that it was explained to me, it's an office that we need anyway for paid sick leave and to come up with sort of to deal with kind of the folks who don't follow this, and what are the fines and how does this all get implemented. And actually, that office is one of the reasons they're talking about the January to April delay, because it's not really where it needs to be yet.
Who's going to be on that commission? Who wants that job?
Well, I actually would imagine there are a lot of people who want that job. Probably a lot of people in the 15 Now movement would like to be on that commission. And they actually wanted an independent commission, I think. But it's a recognition of what a lot of people are saying, that enforcement will be the key to this law. It's so complicated that even any of the four of us could probably not describe the phase-ins and all of that simply in one sentence. So how is a busy, low-wage worker to understand this? And so they will need allies in the enforcement division on their side.
We could do it in one sentence, but the grammar police would be very upset with us.
It would be a very long sentence.
It would be a very long and confusing sentence. One thing Dave Minor did talk about was this, that he thinks the impact is going to be felt, and we'll see, of course, as you say, it's all experiments, that will be felt on the people who make tips, because they will he predicts the service charge will start showing up in Seattle area restaurants instead of tipping. We'll see a shift in the culture. And restaurateurs may make money on that as they distribute the tips or pay taxes on more tip than maybe they've been paying taxes on before because of the way it's been managed. So we may see a change in the culture. That would be a shift as well. We're going to take a break. Come back. We'll talk about the lawsuit by some Seattle police officers against the department over their civil rights. This is The Week in Review.
. 57 degrees in Seattle, heading into the low 70s today, and we're on the verge of a nice string of warm, sunny days.
Support for KUOW comes from AEG Live, presenting the Mary Moore Park Summer Concert Series in Redmond. Just announced, Beck will perform on August 20th. Tickets available for this show and many more at marymooreconcerts.com.
Good morning, it's 10:27. Later today, some thoughts on Jimi Hendrix's influence on American culture and history. We'll examine one particular song, Jimmy's cover version of Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower, to discover what it reveals about the American dream, race relations, and the history of Seattle post-World War II. Join us for that this afternoon at 1:45. Part of KUOW's midday news magazine, The Record, which airs from noon to 2. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
There must be some kind of way out of here. I'm Steve Scherr. Knut Berger is here from Crosscut, Seattle Magazine. What's your new when's your new ebook coming out?
It's already out. Yeah, you can go to the evil Amazon and order a copy. At least you could until I wrote a piece this week.
I just want to know, is there a pre-order button next to your book or not?
Yeah, we'll have to find that out.
Let's look.
I believe it's going to be available on other platforms.
Joni Balter's here. She is a news analyst for KUOW, too.
In addition
to her other duties and responsibilities as a working person. And Eli Sanders is here. He is... Are you associate editor at The Stranger?
Associate editor.
Yeah, I changed your title a little earlier. I'm sorry. Did I demote you when you're assistant editor?
I don't know. Associate or assistant? That might have been a promotion, actually.
All right, good. Okay. Well, we'll call Dan up and tell him.
It's been my lifelong dream to be Dan's assistant.
Yep. Yeah, you will be Dan Savage's assistant. He's gonna hold you to that now.
Oh, man.
This week, over 100 Seattle police officers filed a lawsuit against SPD's new use of force policies. Policies were put in place following a DOJ investigation that there was excessive use of force by the Seattle Police Department. A spokeswoman for the officers filing the lawsuit is Lisa Battaglia. She spoke with Derek Wong of KUOW, and she said that the officers felt there were just a few problem officers who needed reforming.
And instead, what's happened is there's an entire use of force policy, 75 pages long, that's come out of that the police officers believe is not at all in response to what's happening, and in fact has created issues that didn't exist before. It's created a situation where police can't take reasonable response and keep themselves and keep the public safe.
U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkan says that the allegations are groundless. She expects the lawsuit to be dismissed. They are filing on the civil rights violations, which is an interesting approach. Now, Knut, you were saying we were able to read that their lawsuit, and it's pretty interesting reading.
It is interesting reading because you do get the cop on the beat's perspective of what these changes mean. Some of them feel that there's already been a negative effect, which is the rationale for the suit. You have to show some kind of damage. And they're claiming that officers have already been put in jeopardy because they are hesitant to employ force or get into situations where they might have to because they feel like they're unclear about what's legal and what's not. The basic critique, which I also want to say that the lawsuit was kind of written in plain English, which was refreshing.
It wasn't written by a lawyer. Maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know who wrote it, but whoever did, it was untypical of many lawsuits in that it was very straightforward, very easy to follow the arguments. Essentially, they feel that these new regulations freeze officers in having to make split-second decisions, and that as a result, they're going to take a much more conservative approach. That there are claims of what we call depolicing. There's a controversial study that the department released, a couple weeks ago that some people say is invalid, and others say it's evidence of what a lot of people have felt or said they've seen, which is less policing in certain areas and certain types of crimes than before. This lawsuit essentially says that is what's going on.
Which I thought was the most interesting part of this discussion. Whatever you think about the lawsuit's merits, here are police officers saying this is happening.
And exactly. We should have expected, in a way, there to be a sort of a request from the rank and file to be, you know, just help us understand where the line is. This seems predictable to me that there would be a lawsuit, that there not necessarily on those grounds, but on some grounds, whereby the people who have to implement very necessary reforms, say, but at what cost? At what point? Don't forget, as Skip just said, we're talking about split second decisions, and then we find ourselves hesitating. What do we do about this? Well, the reform guidelines apparently go into some detail about what you're supposed to do before you get to that scary moment. You know, you're supposed to be de-escalating, as an example. And so the questioning of you will be, how did you de-escalate? But the officers are telling us, in some ways, their truth, that they're afraid to do things that they used to do because they will have to go through an entire sort of investigative process and answering for their actions.
And at the same time, the Justice Department's truth and the community's truth is that the way that the police department had been behaving in recent years was a problem. They were escalating things too quickly, and so there need to be some changes. And retraining involves moments of uncertainty like this. I thought Ed Murray's response to the police officer's lawsuit was very interesting and very strong. He said, this is not the 1960s. Seattle is not going to be going to war with the U.S. Department of Justice over this, which to me is a very, very overt comparison to the civil rights movement, the civil rights era, the concern that the Seattle Police Department was behaving improperly more frequently toward minority communities, and saying essentially, as I hear it, I'm not going to be like Bull Connor standing in the way of the federal government telling us to do something we need to do, and you shouldn't either, and you should be ashamed of yourselves. That's what I hear in his statement.
I also think the timing's fascinating. It's, you know, minutes after we get a new police chief to come in is sort of taking a stand as she faces, Kathleen O'Toole faces the hearing and the confirmation process. So you have it's either 123 or 126 officers saying, we know you're a reformer, we know the city's committed to reform, but for some of us, we're having trouble with the line.
Well, let's remember, 90% of the police officers are not suing. The union is not supporting the lawsuit.
At all.
That's true.
The police management, the higher-ups are not supporting it. Everybody basically is on the same page, so it represents a small group. But it's worth reading just because it gives you insights into what the police go through, and how one of the things they're concerned about is sort of meeting equal threat with equal threat, but you don't necessarily know what the threat is. In other words, someone could be acting out in such a way that you might pull your gun and the guy isn't a threat with a gun, but what if he does have a gun and you pull out your pepper spray? In other words, they're faced with these sort of decisions that have to do with what might happen, not what is happening. And part of the criticism of the new guidelines is that it appears from their perspective, from the police perspective, that they somehow have to know the future in order to act properly. And that causes a kind of, you know, hesitation that could cost lives of officers.
Just to add quickly to Knut's list of groups that are not supporting this lawsuit, the Seattle Police Department itself put out a statement yesterday saying the SPD does not support this lawsuit.
Here's just on that point as well that you were making. First responding officers, this is from the lawsuit, first responding officers required by the UF, the use of force policy, to delay and avoid immediately resorting to force are left unnecessarily and unreasonably vulnerable when backup fails to come, and the delay and avoidance tactics fail to bring the threat under control. And a little bit further, citizens are feeling vulnerable as patrol officers avoid acting in reasonable response to threats to public safety.
And doesn't that all make you wonder about how they've talked about some of the misdemeanors have not been enforced lately in different places? What is that? Is that intentional, or is that a function of, you know, we're still in training and we don't understand the new rules, so if in doubt, don't kind of thing? Very interesting.
Well, what's also interesting is that this lawsuit does show these officers, their names. I mean, they took a stand, and they said this is a civil rights issue, and they put their names out so that it was clear, everybody could see it, and people know how they feel and what they think. Just sort of an interesting democratic notion for a police department.
Yeah, and the way they described how they got the signatures, they went precinct to precinct. Everybody had a chance. Some of the, you know, command said they were aware of this, but, you know, it didn't say don't sign because you have a right to a lawsuit, obviously. But just that notion that this has been in the works for some time, they've been going around seeing who feels what, who's willing to put a name on something like that.
Lots of North Precinct, few East Precincts, one or two South, Southwest, and the SPD range. So it's more widespread than just one precinct, but the other precincts are underrepresented in the lawsuit. Well, it's an interesting topic. That they do you think in any way does it affect Merrick Bob and the work of the Monitor? I mean, we heard Jenny Durkin saying it has no. She's the U.S. attorney. She's part of this consent decree agreement as the federal agent. Does it affect the movement going forward, do you think?
No, because I think they feel very unified. There's quite a group of them, the mayor, the U.S. attorney, and Merrick Bob, who sort of have been on a course, and a new police chief, clearly on that same course. So they will join hands and go forward, I think.
But the person who it does affect the most, I think, is that new police chief, Kathleen O'Toole. Imagine coming into an organization like this with a huge core of officers having just signed collectively a document that expresses resistance to the direction that she is tasked with taking them.
Yeah, and it's actually stated in the lawsuit that these officers felt that the rank and file were left out of the process of creating the new guidelines, and they make some very sort of sneering comments about people behind desks. And O'Toole is not a street cop. She's going to have to work with them. And I think it puts Jenny Durkin, the U.S. attorney, said that she thought this whole thing basically could be resolved because it's a training issue, that once they go through the training for the new guidelines, it will alleviate a lot of their concerns. That's her argument. But that then, I think, puts more pressure on the implementation phase of having the new chief get credibility and then also implementing it properly, because nobody wants police not enforcing the law. Yeah, especially with dangerous individuals.
Yeah, that first meeting that she'll have with the North Precinct will be an interesting thing. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk about some more of these issues with Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. I'm Steve Scherr. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. By the way, you know, you can find this as a podcast. Go to KUOW.org and search for Week in Review. You can also find it on the various aggregators, including iTunes.
It's everywhere. Every day, KUOW nurtures your knowledge by taking you beyond the headlines for a deeper perspective on important issues. You know that because you listen. KUOW's services are made possible only through the support of listeners like you who value independent news and information. You may have recently received a special appeal in the mail. Please mail back your gift today or make it online at KUOW.org. And thanks. Now, what are you doing tomorrow morning at 10?
This week, President Obama went to Afghanistan and accidentally blew the cover of a senior CIA agent. He was greeting people. He said, "General, good to see you. Lieutenant, I hope you're well. Chief Spy, what are you doing here? I thought you were undercover." I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz that is thankful no one trusts us with their secrets. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska Airlines, supporting Seattle values of ecological sustainability by experimenting with biofuels, fuel-saving wingtip design, and onboard recycling. More at alaskaair.com.
58 degrees and sunny in Seattle, and it's going to be sunny and warm all weekend. By the way, if you're planning on crossing Lake Washington this weekend, here's some news you can use. The 520 floating bridge will be closed this weekend from 11 o'clock tonight until 5 a.m. Monday morning. So you'll need to either take I-90 or go around.
It's the Week in Review with Knute Berger, with Eli Sanders, with Joni Balter. I just want to take a minute to look at that Elliot Rodgers story. Elliot Rodger, the teenager who posted terrible videos and then pulled some of them down after the police came and asked him questions. They weren't very diligent. I think it's fair to say that some of those deputies may be getting some questions in California. And he went on a mass shooting spree. There was a headline I thought was interesting. Writers aren't shy about blaming misogyny and the groups that perpetuate it. I did think it was interesting that Seth Rogen, who last year was a part of our topic when he criticized Macklemore, was shocked and aghast, horrified that the suggestion that his work may have inspired a mass rampage because of the misogyny of his latest film. But how do we think about this?
I think story? It's so interesting that this sort of latest episode and these latest works, because there's so many of these rampages, that instead of it being about guns or knives or violence or mental illness, it is in part also, it's about all those. But it's also about misogyny and sort of, I don't know how to say this nicely, like entitled brats and BMWs who talk about women as things. And then it's brought forth so many different aspects, how men feel at college, how women feel at college. It's just fascinating the way this particular event has unfolded.
Beyond the misogyny, there's that question, as you say, of mental illness. There was one of the victims' fathers speaking out about why was he allowed to have guns, but he was, you know, he was in this system. How his parents had and other people that were involved had called up and said this is a problem person, and yet the system did not deal with him.
So he got his guns legally. We don't know if his parents did. Does anyone know if his parents knew that he had the guns? They just knew he was violent, and they knew he was coming off the deep end here. So, it's a gun story, it's a violence, it's mental health, and now it's misogyny.
And the misogyny story is valid.
Very valid. Very, indeed.
One of the things that's been proposed in response, is a gun restraining order in California. This is one of the ideas for the legislature that's come out of this. And it's actually something that, in reading about it, already exists in Texas, of all places, in Connecticut. And as the Washington State legislature starts to think more seriously, hopefully, about gun control, maybe it's something that can come up there as well. I think the idea is that when a person is in a state of mind like this, people who know him or her can appeal to a judge for a restraining order, much like you would in a domestic violence situation, and say this person should be restrained from owning or purchasing a weapon at this moment.
Well, the story has a lot of interesting elements. One is that a lot went right in the sense that this guy was getting mental health treatment. His parents were concerned and paying attention, at least to some degree. The police went to his house and talked to him and intervened. They just didn't happen to open the door and look in the room where all the guns and ammo were.
Or watch the videos that were of concern to people who had seen
The YouTube videos. So there were a lot of missed things here. What it suggests is that you cannot have 100% control of a crazy person. I mean, you know, in other words, they're going to do what they're going to do. And you can, even if you're doing a lot of things that are right to try and prevent the situation, you can't necessarily stop that person from acting. I think the issue of misogyny and women in our culture is great to talk about. I don't think people are using it as kind of a teaching moment about the larger context and the larger issue, and I think that's fine. But I don't think this guy's a poster child for misogyny or a poster child for anything other than schizophrenia and an aspect of it. You know, and I mean, people claim all kinds of things made them do something. Ted Bundy claimed pornography made him a serial killer. It just, you know, those things just don't add up.
Okay. I'll let Ann Hornaday have the last word, just in part because I think it is interesting that Seth Rogen is the top of the sort of cultural question 2 weeks in a row. Ann Hornaday is the film critic for The Washington Post, and she said, "Mass entertainment has been overwhelmingly controlled by white men whose escapist fantasies so often revolve around vigilantism and sexual wish fulfillment, often if not always featuring a steady through line of casual misogyny." Now I'm going to just switch gears entirely. Just wanted to get that in there. State Supreme Court has some interesting races going on, and we've talked about it a little bit, but you called it, you had a nice post, supremely high stakes.
Right. Well,
which in some ways does echo her training wage and train wreck. Go ahead.
It's the morning of terrible puns. So my point in this was that Supreme Court elections were paid very little attention to, given the stakes of the results. And if you just look at the McCleary decision as an example, here you have the High Court of Washington State forcing, hopefully, our do-nothing legislature to spend billions of dollars to fix our broken education system, which our legislature has been content to let stay broken for years. That is all due to the Supreme Court and to the justices that we have elected to the Supreme Court and to the change in the court's makeup over the year. And so this year we have, with the retirement of Judge Johnson, one of the Johnsons, the more conservative Johnson, the appointment of Mary Yu, the first out lesbian and first Asian American to the Supreme Court. She's going to have to run in the fall, and it will basically be a public confirmation of the appointment because she drew no opponent, which is odd and lucky for her. But the result of this election in the fall will help position her for when she has to run again in 2016. An interesting footnote to that, imagine a ballot where Hillary Clinton is at the top in Washington State and another groundbreaking female elected official is at the very, very bottom. It could help her, Judge Yu, I mean. And then another race that we've got going is Justice Deborah Steffens, who is running in the most interesting race out there, I think, against an attorney who she helped disbar. His name is John Scannell. His nickname is Zamboni. He drives a Zamboni and was also a lawyer and is not pleased with his disbarment, let's say that. And then we have Charles Johnson also up for election against a relative unknown named Eddie Yoon. And what I found most interesting in that race is that Johnson actually won as a relative unknown many years ago when he was running against an incumbent justice who was widely respected, well endorsed, but had the unfortunate last name of Callow. He was Justice Keith Callow. Shows you again how little attention is paid to these very consequential elections and how sometimes people just pick based on names. So the point here was just to say, pay attention.
Yeah. Especially when you have somebody with Zamboni as their nickname. Knut, I walk around the news U district because this is where we are, and you wrote this two long pieces about the future of the U district, and you focused on the place of the street kids. And what I found so fascinating in the article was, let's incorporate their energy into thinking about the future of this district. Let's have them help plan how this place is going to look when 7,000 more housing units are in place and many more jobs in the next 20 years.
Well, yeah, the U District is sort of ground zero from a lot of different directions of major change, which is coming, looking at redoing the zoning of the district. That's coming up. The Lights Rail Station is going to be built at 43rd and Brooklyn. The University of Washington wants to turn, as a spokesman there said, turn the U District into South Lake Union North. They want high-tech startups and they want high-tech jobs here. So it's a lot of planning, a lot of stuff is going on. And I wanted to look at the issue of there's such a large resident if that's not a contradiction in terms, but a resident population of transient young people. And they're here for a reason. They're here because of the university. This is where their peers are, young people their age. They're here because of things like coffee houses and cheap food. They're here because a lot of social services are here, particularly ones run through the churches in the neighborhood, many of which have programs, shelters, needle exchange, you know, those kinds of programs. So my approach is there's recognition that the area needs more public space. When you talk about new public space in the U District, people freak out because they're worried about street kids taking over. And the question
Wasn't
is
that some comments you got? Somebody was looking at the different public spaces. Yeah, what are you gonna do?
Yeah.
What are you gonna, how are you gonna keep the
how
homeless
are you gonna
out?
Keep the homeless out. It was the first thing. So there are ideas about putting a public plaza at 43rd and Brooklyn. There are ideas about there's a parklet that's gonna be on 43rd as kind of an experiment. There is a lot of discussion, but it tends to exclude this population. And there are people who are really many of them really bonded to the neighborhood. I talked to Shiloh Murphy, who's a former U District AVRAT, and they have a Facebook page for alumni AVRATs. They get together for a barbecue every summer. He runs the Needle Exchange program, and you know, he was talking about the kind of intense loyalty people feel to the neighborhood and to helping other people here. So they're here. What do you do? How do you create a new U District that doesn't displace folks that need help?
I was struck in your articles by the amount of upzoning and huge development and change that is coming to the U District. And then if you think about it, many other neighborhoods in Seattle. And that's just something that's here now, you know, fastest growing city, good and bad, you know, it's going to change.
But if you think about transit-oriented development, the U District is a perfect place.
Yeah.
Because it already is heavily transit-oriented. It's going to have a light rail station with 12,000 boardings a day. You're going to have a lot of people who want – it already has an urban – it's an urban neighborhood.
Yes.
Already. It's not – and so the question is how do you maximize the opportunity while still making it an affordable and livable place? And this is the question that keeps coming up all over Seattle is how do you make sure the development doesn't push everyone out, the artists, the students, the, you know, whatever. And you know, how do you do that? And how do you provide public benefit in the way of parks and things like that?
It's good stories. I was struck just real quick. So we're going to see the University Tower dominates the University District skyline. We're going to see a tower, at least one tower, almost that size, or maybe.
Well, it depends on the draft EIS. You know, there are three zoning options, one of which is more or less the same as it is now, and two are more aggressive in terms of density. And there would be allowed in that area towers up to, I think, 360 feet, if I'm not.
Wow.
I can't remember my own figure there, but it's taller than UW Tower. So, yeah, I think there will be more towers here.
Wow. Hey, speaking of AVRATs, you know, if I'm not mistaken, I think Luke Burbank started his career as an AVRAT. Is that right, Luke?
No, I used to hang out at Green Lake where they had breakdancing back in the early 80s. And these kids would
And could you?
Up. What's that, Johnny?
Could you breakdance?
I was in a crew called the Backstreet Breakers. We were, in fact, on Music Magic briefly. On King 5, we made an appearance. And I couldn't do any of those moves now if you paid me $1 million.
Wow, you were on King TV's Music Magic as a breakdancer?
Get the tape.
I was the small white kid.
Oh, we are looking for that. Somebody's got to have that tape, Luke. Luke Burbank is host of Livewire and the TBTL podcast. Are you still doing commentaries on CBS Sunday Morning?
When they let me.
Well, that's nice. Here's my question, and I'm going to let Rick Anderson actually start us answering this question. Ramtha is a 35,000-year-old spirit guide, and he speaks through J.Z. Knight, the teacher, the writer, the major donor to Thurston County Democrats. And Ramtha was spouting some stuff that Rick Anderson, who writes for the Seattle Weekly, gives us a little sample of. We talked to him earlier this week.
She says, in court only, that the video takes the comments out of context. When she's shown in one clip saying F you Catholics, you ass, for example. She claims she is reacting to the church's history of allowing priests to serially abuse boys.
I just was surprised that Ramtha, a 35,000-year-old spirit, was using that kind of language. But maybe I shouldn't be surprised, Luke. Maybe that's just how it goes.
Who knew this whole time she was channeling everyone's drunk uncle?
Yeah, exactly. I think her defense was Ramtha is like a Jon Stewart character.
You cannot let Ramtha have too many Coors Lights, or it just gets really racist really fast. What I find bizarre about this story is that as I understand it, the spiel is Jay-Z Knight is channeling some other being. She has no control over what's being said. But then when that being says something that we all agree seems pretty homophobic and racist, she then says, no, that's not what he meant. And then she sort of contextualizes it. I mean, what if he just is a racist? I mean, he's really old. It's possible.
Who knows how the Atlanteans were thinking about other people? We just don't know. Skip, did you write some story about Jay-Z Knight that got you in trouble?
Well, I wrote a column some years ago criticizing RFK Jr. for going down to Ramtha land to get money and do a speaking thing. And she's given a lot of money to Democrats. So people have been pointing out this racist stuff, saying that, you know, local and national Democrats and Obama and others shouldn't be taking money. Other people have come to her defense. And she threatened to sue the Weekly, I don't know, some 5, 6, 7 years ago.
She seems after folks who are trying to explain her little friend's comments and ideas. That's why she's going against the Evergreen Freedom Foundation for displaying this vid, as Rick Anderson sort of annoyingly kept calling it video. But she has other troubles. What about the lie cocktail that some folks are after her for using as part of an Enlightenment kind of event?
Wow. Well, I was just going to suggest that she might be an interesting guest for LiveWire, Luke, but I guess maybe not.
The thing is that Ramtha will not fly anywhere. Very, very afraid of airplanes. And photography, it turns out. He thinks it will steal his soul. So it's tough to get her to LiveWire. But we do have somebody amazing on the show tonight, a guy named Jason Padgett, who's from Tacoma. He was, quite unfortunately, assaulted outside of a karaoke bar in Tacoma. But when he came to, he had incredible mathematical abilities that he hadn't had before, and he's a savant now. He's an acquired savant, which is very rare. And he explains relativity in about a minute in a way that I've never been able to understand before.
That's cool. LiveWire is on tonight at 8 from Portland on KUOW Seattle. I have no time to have any of you comment on the fact that Steve Ballmer has decided to buy a basketball team in Los Angeles. But I'm sure we'll all be rooting for the team from now on, right? Clippers fans.
Maybe not.
Luke Burbank, thank you very much. He is the host of LiveWire at 8 o'clock on KUOW. Knute Berger, thank you very much. He is the host of the Mossback column at Crosscut.
Thank you.
Eli Sanders, thank you very much. He is the associate editor at The Stranger. And Joni Balter is host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. And I am Steve Scher, host of The Weekend Review. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.